Lessons from 1918. The influenza pandemic of 1918, often called the Spanish flu, killed an estimated 10 to 20 million people worldwide and 5,000 here in Maine. Now, a century later, many are looking back, trying to identify similarities and differences between that virus and COVID-19. The hope that lessons from that time might help us understand how long this pandemic might last and what we need to do to avoid so many deaths. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will turn back the clock to a time when a highly contagious and swift-moving influenza devastated Maine, the nation, and the world. How did the virus behave? How was public information disseminated or not? What made it end? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As we cope with the pandemic of COVID-19, there has been a surge of interest in the worldwide pandemic of 1918. Are there lessons from that that apply to us today? That's what we'll be discussing during this hour. My guests are Dr. Richie Kahn. He's a retired internist who served for a time as chief medical resident at Maine Medical Center. His interest in medical history goes back to medical school, and his book, Diseases in the District of Maine, 1772 to 1820, the unpublished work of Jeremiah Baker, a rural physician in New England, will be published this August. Also hear Jamie Rice, who is Director of Collections and Research at the Maine Historical Society. She's also on the line with us. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the so-called Spanish flu? Have you been thinking about parallels? Have you been reading about it? You can send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on today's Facebook post, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you. I know there's so much interest in this topic. I think an hour's not going to be enough, but we're going to do our best. Jamie, I'll start with you. I have read that the 1918 influenza killed 5,000 people in Maine. What areas were most badly affected?
Well, in Maine, the coastal communities, certainly larger cities, but also coastal communities, because of the World War One and the traffic for shipping, for transporting troops, those areas. So places like Portland, places like Bangor, you also see Bath and Eastport. So the coastal communities and the urban communities were certainly most affected by the pandemic.
All right. And there's some important differences. In Maine, we're seeing, even though in both cases, Cumberland County was hit hard, there are places in the 1918, such as Aroostook County, that saw a lot of deaths, weren't there, that aren't seeing it, at least at this point here.
Right. I think the World War One, in the context of the war, the Canadian border was quite active. Both countries were involved in the conflict overseas. And there's a lot of commerce going between shipping of goods, shipping of war products, shipping of commercial products, and keeping that sort of close to the border. So that's why I think you see a lot more of a concentrated effort up towards the border areas.
Dr. Kahn, I want to ask you about the virus, the difference in the viruses that caused the 1918 pandemic and the one that we're seeing today with COVID-19. Are they similar? For example, in 1918, was it a respiratory? Was it contagious by coughing and sneezing?
Absolutely. Coughing, sneezing. September 25th, 1918, the Maine Department of Health warned that secretions transmitted by coughing, sneezing, and sharing utensils and towels would be the way it was being transmitted. It was being brought by, as Jamie knows, from Camp Devens was in Massachusetts, was pounded with this influenza, and relatives went down there, visited their sick people, and came back to places like Maine and probably brought it. That was probably how it originally got into Maine. But it's a different
virus. That's right. I understand something like 45,000 troops from around New England at a fort that was designed for many fewer, and that the the 1918 influenza just tore through Camp Devens. I'm sorry, I think I cut you off though. Are you saying that back then they didn't understand it was a virus?
No, that's true too. First of all, we know today, we have to watch out for presentism. Presentism is what historians talk about. We have to try to put ourselves into, in this case, 1918. What did they know? You know, what did they know at the time? We can't say, well, why didn't they just do this? Why didn't they get X-rays that were available then? But why didn't they do this? Things we know today that they didn't know then. So it was a disease that, the word influenza comes from the word influence, Italian, influenza, influence of the stars, influence of Noah Webster, for example, wrote a 2-volume book on epidemics and pestilential disease in 1799, and there's 6 pages of epidemics going back to the 12th century that they had these things that sounded like to Noah Webster. That's Dictionary Webster, by the way. It sounded like influenza, and he tried to relate them, and other people too. This wasn't just Webster, to volcanoes and earthquakes, and made sense. And that's, that also has to do with another post hoc ergo propter hoc. It happened after, therefore a cause. We don't like to think that either nature or God has a dartboard and just said, okay, this is what's going to happen in Maine this year. Or this is what we like. Is there a reason trying to make sense? And they were trying to make sense. They weren't stupid. They were trying to make sense of it. Why was 1 year a bad year? Why did, in this case, 1918, why was it such a bad year? And I must say, we have ideas. We know a lot more than we knew then, but it's still unpredictable. It's predictable that we're going to have epidemics, but it's not perfectly predictable that this is going to be the year for, in this case, COVID-19. But it's a different virus than the influenza virus. And as you know, there's been viruses, almost every year there's one. We get flu vaccine. Most of us, or many of us, get flu vaccine. But to answer your question more directly, in 1918, they didn't know about viruses. They didn't see viruses. It wasn't until the 1930s. Okay, so you have to go back. What did they see? And I just found that, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you know about bacteria, which they knew from the 1860s, 70s, 80s, so it was really just they could find bacteria, and they would find people who died in one of the influenza epidemics even before 1918, and they would do autopsies, and we had bacteriology, but not virology. And they would find certain bacteria, and they'd say, this is what's causing it. You might have a group of people that, 6 people had autopsies, and 5 of them had a particular bacteria. This is the cause. And it wasn't. I mean, it was. That's a secondary invader.
Right. It seems from what I've read about the 1918 influenza that it was deadlier faster, that people would show symptoms and the next day they'd be dead.
Well, that's a very good, it was different. It's an H1N1. They have names, like we have names, how you tell one from another. They look at them and they're a little bit different. Is it avian related or swine related? That one was avian. And I don't think it's absolutely known why. Why one is so bad, but in what you're saying is absolutely so. In 1918, there were some people would have the classic flu, fever, ache, headache, cough, and muscle aches. That was one of the things. So that was common, and you could have a relatively mild case or a bad case, just like the COVID, COVID-19 we're going through now. But the other thing that was different, as you're pointing, and a certain percentage would get pneumonia, secondary. They'd have the influenza, and then a week or two later, instead of getting better, they may even have started to get better, but they get a secondary infection, a bacteria that normally we breathe in and out, no problem. But when you're debilitated like that, they can get in there into someone who has a viral pneumonia, and then they also have a bacterial pneumonia. And this is before antibiotics. The antibiotics, sulfan is about 35, penicillin in the 40s. So no antibiotic. But the other thing that can happen to people is when you're talking about, Jennifer, and sometimes was referred to as the purple death within 24 hours. So somebody would go, by the way, have either of you ever had influenza? Do you think
no.
the real thing?
No.
Well, I've had it once in 74. And I must say, I can't remember the status of the vaccines. There were vaccines then. But I remember I went to work, and I can't remember the exact hour, noon or 1 o'clock. I was feeling fine. I was 34 years old, non-smoker, felt fine. And within an hour, I felt like someone had beaten me with 2x4s, high fever, muscle aches, just absolutely terrible, headache. And I've said to my wife, I've said, now I know what people mean when they say, I wish I were dead. You know, where it's, but it comes on that sort of gangbusters, as I say, within an hour from feeling fine to wish you were dead. It's not the, you know, it's not like people use the word flu. I had the flu for a lot of viral, you know, I had a cold. I felt kind of yucky yesterday. Today I'm coughing a little more. Don't feel great and that sort of thing. But the real influenza, what I just talked about then, that's the one that tends to, you know, if you have people who are elderly, debilitated, heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, are more likely to succumb to the disease. But this one of the things that was different about this 1918 H1N1 was that people would, almost half the deaths were between 20 and 40. I could be off a little bit, but somewhere in that range. And that's
right. And that was one of the things that was so surprising, is that young men, healthy people in the prime of life were being
right.
stricken. Jamie, I want to turn to you and I want to ask you to compare the response. I understand that just like today, many public places were closed, like theaters and churches. Were there what we would call today sheltering in place orders? Were people told to stay home?
They certainly were. Schools were closed. Churches were closed. Public. There was a parade in Philadelphia that proceeded as planned, and that's kind of seen as sort of that last major event where the virus spread in 1918 spread so wide from the attendees that was sort of the catalyst for a lot of what we would consider to be sort of stay-at-home orders. And a lot of places were closed. But when you look at it also, we're, as a country, we're in the middle of a war. So there's still a lot of war effort, home front, munitions-related activities that needed to continue. Agriculture needed to continue to support the war effort, to support the home front. So you do see a lot of those areas closed, but you also see a lot of production still open because we were engaged in active conflict, a significantly large active conflict. And for the American military, it's really one of the major first international conflicts that you see the United States in, and really had to ramp up to support that effort for what was largely a small military at the time. So you do see it's yes and no, but there
right.
were activities like you see today where public activities were curtailed, schools were closed, churches were
and
closed.
And I understand just like today, there was some pushback. There were people who wanted to keep churches open, for example, and there are people who didn't want to have to keep their businesses shut.
Well, of course. I mean, certainly the as we see today with the impact on the economy, there is a lot of pushback. But something else that we don't have today that we did have in 1918 is that there was a real sentiment of public opinion that to speak against the government or to speak against the war effort was unpatriotic and in some places even criminal. So you do see some pushback, but there was a whole sentiment that it was unpatriotic to not participate in what would further the war effort. So there's a whole nother layer of complexity with World War One era that we don't have today. Fortunately, don't have today.
So an important difference as we look about this. Yeah. So, Dr. Khan, I want to ask you, a lot has been made about the waves that the 1918 influenza seemed to have, that there was first kind of a mild wave in the spring of 1918, but then it came back, a more virulent strain came back in the fall. Is that, in your view, something that's parallel today, that could be parallel today, that we need to watch for? If so, are we in that first wave or the second wave? How do you think about it?
I think we're in the first wave, and it's difficult to say, because that was, remember, that was the end of the war was what, November? I can't remember the exact date. And so the troops were coming back too. So people were starting
right,
to,
November
and
of 18,
so all the
yeah,
people
November
that were packed
18.
Into barracks in this country, you know, and coming from abroad would start coming back with their influenza. I'd like to just, you know, a couple things more about what Jamie was saying. You know, what happened in Maine is was your question. Well, in October 16th, Governor Milliken appointed a special emergency influenza committee with Dr. Bristol, State Commissioner of Health. He was in charge, and Sewell was State Public Safety Commission. Mr. Smith was American Red Cross, and then it was two physicians that were with the U.S. Public Health Service. They had a $10,000 emergency appropriation, which it's difficult to calculate, but I figure it's something like $189,000 today. And each had a job, you know, general work for the committee. One was ordering and collecting supplies for the emergency hospitals, obtaining nurses, transportation, and opening emergency hospitals. And the two physicians, public health, had to do with getting physicians and nurses for the local communities. Remember, this was war, as Jamie said, and lots of the physicians and nurses had gone to the war, so there was a shortage. So what was done? Nurses were sent to 50 communities, doctors to 26 communities. 23 hospitals were set up in 18 communities. Many set up their own emergency hospital. And just as an example, I live in, you know, Martinsville, you know, near Tenants Harbor. But October 11th, Camden, the Congregational Church vestry, was converted to a hospital and was full of cot beds to take care of the sick. The other thing I thought was interesting that I came across, that 21,290 doses of influenza vaccine were made and distributed. Now, again, this is before they knew that it was virus, and it was one of those early bacteria. They thought if we made it, killed it, the bacteria, we might be able to protect. It didn't work, but it was given to a lot of people. And I communicated with John Eiler, who wrote the major paper on this just the past couple days, and he confirmed that's what it was. I'm sure that's what they were giving. And it also raises the issue. We have to be careful in 2020 that there's been so much money put into research, and there's so much, you know, every time you pick up a paper, magazine, and all the medical journals, all these articles, and stuff is being pushed out, quote, science, and it hasn't really gone through the peer review process, all the things that would normally you'd want to do first before you let anything go, and politics has entered into it. So that, we've got to be careful about that. And let's see, I just wanted to say, one thing you were asking about, so the problems, early diagnosis, when somebody first noticed, are you sure this is flu? And then it became obvious with people, you know, dropping like flies and a lot of deaths. And on October 4th, Dr. Bristol closed all the churches. Now, that proved to be a problem, as it is today. If you read, you read the papers today, not all churches are very happy with this. So this is an issue of public health versus civil liberty. The First Amendment says, the Constitution says, there shouldn't be anything impeding the free exercise of religion for its citizens. Now, that's interesting. Well, in October 9th, in Lewiston, Monsignor McDonough, he was pastor of the St. Patrick's Church, and Dr. Epstein was chairman of the Lewiston Board of Health. And they went through this. They're trying to close all the churches. And McDonough says, do you consider factories or mills public gatherings? And Epstein says something, well, they're different. They're necessary to sustain life. So the priest says, so you think there are times when the church is not essential? You can see where that's going.
But the church is in response to what Richie is saying, a lot of churches were converted to medical facilities,
right.
Especially in urban areas. And even Mercy Hospital in Portland was founded as a result of the Spanish flu. Like the nuns were called to action, and the whole precipitous of that hospital was in response to the fact that the medical community was small, that a lot of the personnel was involved in Europe in the war, and that the communities needed to respond to that. So in some ways, the church is really, and the church and the religious communities really stepped up and moved in to support the health community. And going back to like the waves, when you see the war, the armistice was November 11th, and the second most aggravated wave of the Spanish flu kind of came a few months before that. As Rich mentioned, with a lot of soldiers and a lot of preparedness, so you see a lot of these camps, including Camp Devens and lots of places across the United States, gearing up for a war effort and congregating a lot of young men. They had widened the draft ages, and you see people start to congregate. But the flu comes back again in 1919, as the war technically doesn't end until June of 1919 when the treaty is signed. And that's when you really start to see the influx of soldiers coming back to the United States and the large movement of troops to demilitarize. And then you see another influx of the Spanish flu. So it's a lot of up and down, but largely because of these mass movements of people.
Jamie, I'm so glad you mentioned Mercy. I have to go to a break. We're going late. But Jamie, I'm so glad you mentioned about Mercy Hospital's founding coming after the 1918 influenza. We do need to go to a quick break. More of your comments and questions when we get back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Modern Pest Services, offering a non-toxic approach to pest control with anti-CMEX smart pest control technology. modernpest.com, and Bangor Savings Bank, celebrating all the ways people all over Maine are making life a little better. bangor.com/spreadkindness.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with some of the mayors who are reopening America's cities, trying to restart their economies without putting huge numbers of people at risk. And we'll hear from Jill Lepore on the lessons of polio.
One of the reasons I study history is I like to see how things began so that I can imagine how bad things end.
Jill Lepore, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
And that's coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 and Sunday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Hi, it's Mark Vogelsang, Maine Public CEO, with my deep thanks for contributing during our radio Pledge from Home fundraiser. With your help, the drive was a success, which will continue to allow Maine Public to serve our community with strong, independent journalism that informs and connects, music that inspires, and programming that serves all Mainers of all ages and in all locations. Your voice is a powerful one. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, comparing and contrasting the Spanish flu and today's pandemic. My guests are Jamie Rice, Director of Collections and Research with the Maine Historical Society, and Richie Kahn, a retired internist who has a deep interest in medical history in a book coming out this August. We invite you to be part of the conversation. Our email address is talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to an email from Jean. She writes, in my most recent novel, Teddy Roosevelt, Millie in the Elegant Ride, I touch on the 1918 flu pandemic in Portland, as well as the devastating impact at Fort Devens, then called Camp Devens in Massachusetts, where men from Maine and our sister states were sent for combat training for the war in Europe. Jean Flahive writes, during my research and writing, I remember asking myself, I wonder if a pandemic on that scale will happen again. And here I am wearing a mask. And then from Nori, who is a high school student, she writes, our National History Day project titled The Pandemic of 1918, Its Impact on Public Health Policies in Maine and Beyond, began back in January as an exercise in exploring an event that had significant impact at the time and is still profoundly relevant today. Our initial goal was to outline lessons learned from a century ago, but as the novel coronavirus spread, we seized the opportunity to draw parallels and create our own historical record of observations and analysis amidst yet another staggering global pandemic. One critical takeaway in our analysis is the importance of effective communication and cooperation, and accurate global reporting and clear directives are absolutely essential. Today, we have excellent public health experts and skilled communicators like Maine CDC's Dr. Shaw and NIAID's Dr. Fauci. Dr. Khan.
I just wanted to say one more thing about this religion. The churches certainly did. I didn't want to mean that as a put down for churches. They really responded. But I just, there was, it was a MMWR, Morbidity and Mortality Weekly, just, well, this week, a report of a choir practice. And I just think of a church in Lewiston, full church with everybody belting out a hymn. And this, in this study of, I think it was 60-something people, one person had COVID-19, and 87% of the group developed it.
Right, right.
Positive.
Jamie,
that's,
I want to, yeah.
One person singing, and I just picture the church packed and everybody singing would have been really spreading it. Go on, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Jamie. I just wanted to ask you about your response to Nori and the difference between public communication then and now and the kind of messaging that people are able to hear today, every day, in fact, here in Maine from Dr. Shaw. What was it like back then? What were people hearing and from whom?
Well, at first, the virus was the 1918, the Spanish flu, as it's called, was really downplayed in the media for a couple of reasons. One, to not instill a lot of widespread fear, which we can see the correlations between that and COVID-19, and also to not impede the war effort. And it's actually called the Spanish flu for a media-related activity just the same. Spain was not involved in the conflict, not at a large level, largely neutral. And the press was not censored in the way that even the American or other European or any kind of belligerent nation, their press was censored at that time. So it seemed disproportionately that the virus was widespread in Spain. And actually a lot of evidence to indicate that it started, Dr. Khan could speak better that than I could, in the United States, but called the Spanish flu now for 100 years because of the media coverage that it was receiving. And so as you start to see the virus progress, as Dr. Khan mentioned, there's a lot of task force and boards and councils put together, and start to see a lot more public health communication. But the ability for the media to be able to report freely and openly has its pros and cons, but that's one of the benefits of the communication today is for the people to be informed as much as possible and not rely on one central targeted narrative.
And I want to talk about an email that's related to what you just said, Jamie. This is from Noah. If we don't find it acceptable when the president and others refer to the Wuhan virus, it should be far less acceptable to stigmatize the Spain for the sin of being neutral in World War One. Please consider other nomenclature. And Noah, I completely understand. That's why I said in the beginning of the show, the so-called Spanish flu, it becomes, doesn't it, some point, Jamie, even if you don't like what it's called, what it has been called and how people refer to something in shorthand.
Absolutely. Right. And you can see the connection of that.
That's right, Jamie. And I mean, I think the Spanish is a little bit different. Now, they're calling it the Chinese, the COVID, the Chinese disease. It goes way back. I mean, people did that. For example, the French call syphilis the English disease, and the English call it the French disease. And frequently it has to do with xenophobia. So in addition to, not helping, it also stigmatizes people. So if it seems to have come from, say, Asia, anybody walking around that appears Asian might be stigmatized, might be treated in a bad way.
Right.
And that's one of the things that's wrong with using those terms.
Well, it's thinking about the virus as a foreign invasion, and it's something was put upon us and that we're not responsible for, and now we have to repel in the same way that you might with a foreign invasion. So it does speak a lot to the way people kind of conceptualize what they're dealing with.
On the line with us now is Tilly Lasky. She's curator with the Maine Historical Society in Portland. Tilly, welcome back. And I understand the Maine Historical Society is in the process of treating this pandemic as history, and you're collecting stories not only from that time, but this time. Tell us about the project.
Sure. Maine Historical Society manages Maine Memory Network, which is a digital statewide museum. And traditionally, for the last 19 years, it's been a consortium of 270 institutional partners. And just recently, we opened up Maine Memory to individuals because we recognize that the majority of Maine's history is in private hands rather than institutional. And so what we did is we created a platform for sharing these personal histories. And because, as you've been mentioning in the program, there are so many natural similarities between COVID-19 and other pandemics, we've been looking in our archives to try and find those personal histories. And while we have a lot of, like, three-dimensional objects and newspaper accounts, we really don't have those personal histories of what it was like living through that time. And so we're looking for anybody who might, in their family archives, have a story like that about the Spanish flu or about TB or polio, especially. There's still a lot of polio survivors out there. So we're really seeking some of those historical stories about that prior pandemic, as well as stories about COVID-19 and how people are weathering the storm today.
Super, Tilly. And we will put links to that project on the Maine Calling webpage and Facebook page. Thank you so much for calling in. That's Tilly Lasky, a curator with the Maine Historical Society in Portland. We're going to go to Ellery calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. As was alluded to earlier, there was coverage and news and things of that sort years ago. But there's also this steady stream of 24-hour news, internet, visual images. So I'm thinking if it influences behavior, some of the things we have nowadays. For example, when we see broadcasters on a TV station wearing a mask, that's a very powerful image. And whether that changes people's minds about things, and a president who chooses not to, these are very powerful images. And I was wondering if that also makes an influence on how people respond to the call for to do this or to do that for with an influenza.
Jamie, do you have thoughts?
Well, I think certainly imagery is an important piece of the puzzle, and to draw a relationship between what we see today and what we were seeing in 1918 is there was a strong and very active propaganda machine that the government was using during the 1918 to project that imagery. And, as you know, the images that you see today, like you said, are through 24-hour news media and through online. So imagery is always a tool that can be used for both good and bad, but to help inform or to aims to inform choices that we're making as individuals. And by teaching by example, or as you know, with the kind of the, as Dr. Khan was saying, with inundating us with quote-unquote science or messages that may not be vetted, but also to be able to communicate to people steps and things that they can do to help keep themselves and their neighbors safe. So I think you can see both sides of the coin, but there's a strong relationship. Even though the methods are very different between now and 1918, you can see a strong relationship between the uses of imagery and communication.
Ellery, thanks so much for your question. Barbara on Facebook asks, how did the 1918 influenza pandemic come to an end? Can the knowledge of that help to end this pandemic? Dr. Khan, do we know how it ended?
It just ended. I don't know. It wasn't anything that we did, I think is one way to put it. I think that I don't think, I guess the short answer is I don't know. And I'm reading a book, if somebody's really interested in that, just came out, The Rules of Contagion, Why Things Spread and Why They Don't. Adam Kucharski just came out. He's an associate professor at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And this book is about exactly that subject. And it has to do, you know, it must have to do with a number of people that are already infected. And you end up at some point where there's not enough people most people are protected. That's one way. And it just dies. It has to be in a person that is not immune. But the short answer, I don't think I can give you exactly why it ends. But I can say it's not something that we did. You know, it's not something that, whether it was, I told you about those vaccines that were bacterial vaccines. It's a very good question. And this book, I mean, I just started it recently, may have the answer. He's a mathematician and epidemiologist. You know, and they're, you know, trying to, there are ways of looking at the math. You know, this is, it goes this way. But there's two, Gina Colata just had an article in the New York Times this week, I think, on how pandemics end. And she points out that there's two endings. One is medical and one is social.
Mm-hmm.
And the medical is the number of new cases decreases, and eventually it just peters out. That's one part. But the other is the social. I mean, the stigmatizing people, the politics of it. So there's a whole lot of social issues that could either keep the pandemic going longer or cut it shorter. I mean, if it's an excellent question, and I don't feel I have a good answer.
I don't think anybody does.
That's so fascinating. We do need to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments about the 1918 Spanish flu and lessons we can learn today. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Cumberland Crossing, a new retirement community offering access to ocean view at Falmouth's Care Continuum. CumberlandCrossingRC.com. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Harold T. Andrews of Portland enlisted in the United States Army on May 15, 1917. He was the first Maine casualty from World War I. Andrews died in the Battle of Cambrai in France in late November 1917. First-hand reports detail how he jumped on an abandoned machine gun and tried to defend himself and others as the Germans advanced on his position. The Andrews Square Memorial was created in his memory in 1921 in Portland's West End neighborhood.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine! The Daily Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus will take place this afternoon at 2 o'clock. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, each day's address is archived at mainepublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is scheduled for 2 o'clock this afternoon and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, mainepublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking today about the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 and parallels to today. My guests are Dr. Richie Kahn, a retired internist who specializes in medical history and has a book coming out in August, and Jamie Rice with the Maine Historical Society of Portland. Join our conversation. Call us at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. An email here from Lenny. My grandmother gave birth to my mother December 10th, 1918. Well, she was ill with the Spanish flu. She did not know she had the baby until she recovered. My mother was underweight when born, delivered by my great-grandmother, who was also a traveling midwife. They lived in South Portland. My grandmother lived to be 90 years old, and my mother lived to be 97. Both women were miraculous tales of survival. My grandmother had 12 additional children after recovery. Three sons served in World War II and survived to live into their late 80s and 90s. Another son served during the rebuilding of Japan, and another served in Korea and Vietnam. I have a feeling, Jamie, that this is the exact kind of story Tilly Lasky wants to hear.
Absolutely. These are the exact kind of stories that we're trying to collect at the Maine Historical Society. And it really, exactly.
Yeah, we don't want this to be too much of a downer. Maybe we should be talking about what are the positive things about the 1918 flu epidemic.
Yeah,
I just wanted to make one other point. I think one of the differences between 1918 and earlier and now is expectations, our expectations as just people, citizens. And 100 years ago, or certainly 200 years ago, that was more a part of everyday life. I mean, in the early part of the 20th century, infectious disease were the three leading causes of death, mostly consumption, tuberculosis, but other infections. Now, at the end of the 20th century, that's reversed. I mean, that's way down the list, and it's heart disease, cancer, strokes, and things like that. But the point that I think our expectations were death, whereas death was a part of everyday life, to nowadays, no one I love or know should die. I mean, and I think it's quite different. I mean, you know, you look at cemeteries from 100 years ago, and it's somebody age 1, age 5, age 7, age 11. You just don't see that, thank goodness, these days. And I think that's an important point. And one other point, I think medicine in general, absolute certainty is unattainable. And that's what we're stuck with. We as doctors, we as patients, we as community, we can do the best we can with the information available at the time, and that's what we're stuck with. And for anyone, you know, this is what may happen 9 out of 10 times. The 10th time, it's going to be something different, something that wasn't expected, either good or bad. I mean, it could go in either direction. I'm sorry, but I just wanted to get that.
Oh, no, don't apologize. I'm going to read a couple more emails. This is an email from Sandra. During the 1918 flu epidemic, my 10-year-old grandfather and his family were so sick they were unable to care for themselves. The American Red Cross came into their home in Bar Harbor to nurse them back to health. My grandfather was so grateful for them saving their lives that when he became an adult, he joined the Board of Trustees for the Maine chapter of the American Red Cross. My husband's family was not so lucky. His pregnant great-grandmother nursed her husband and children back to health from the 1918 flu. She then caught the disease herself and died in a Presque Isle hospital. The family was broken up, and their surviving children were farmed out to other families. Both of these events happened during the second wave of the 1918 flu. And then Denim on Facebook writes, my father, who was born in 1911, spoke of having the Spanish flu, and when the doctor came to visit him at home, the doctor was wearing a raincoat, the PPE of the day. We'll go to Scott, who's calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Jennifer. I'm a physician and also a little bit of a historian. A lot of people don't remember that Maine had a medical school in Brunswick until around 1920. So I'd be curious if your panelists think that the Maine medical school's failure in around 1920 was perhaps related to that vaccine effort. Or was it more political in terms of resources and just the general medical education philosophy of the day?
I think that was probably unrelated, although this didn't help. But what was the report? I can't think of its name. 1910 or 11. They went around to all the medical schools, and there were a lot that were really not quality medical schools, and a lot of medical schools closed all over the country. A number of them, for example, Dartmouth, went from a 4-year to a 2-year school for a while. But that I think that's what brought it down. There weren't enough. For example, the school was in Brunswick at Bowdoin. They did have some facilities in Portland, Maine General Hospital, but it was happening all over. It was a small school, didn't have enough laboratory, enough clinical material, they felt. The Flexner report is what I was thinking of. If you look up the Flexner report, it wasn't only the Flexner report, but that was what was happening in medicine in general. So I would say that's more likely than the influenza.
Scott, thanks so much for your call and your question. Let's see, we'll go to Margie calling from Jonesboro. Hi, Margie.
Hi. Well,
go ahead.
I still have pneumonia now. I got it the very end of July. January, and they gave me antibiotic. And I still have it, and I called the hospital, and they said that, well, it'll probably take 5-6 months. And I'm wondering what your doctor thinks of that. I mean, you know, this is ridiculous. You don't have any energy, and you're breathing. You know, you got to take, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in. And I just want to know, you know, how long does it take to, or what do they have for pneumonia?
Margie, thanks so much for calling. I hope you feel better. And I'll just ask you quickly, Dr. Kahn, is several months typical to get rid of pneumonia?
No, it's not typical, but there's a wide range. Some people, first of all, at one end of the continuum is somebody's going to work. I'm not talking about COVID-19, but just has pneumonia, quote, walking pneumonia, and they're going to work. And they don't feel great, but nothing terrible. And at the other end is somebody in the intensive care unit on oxygen and intravenous and all that. Most people get better in a shorter time than that. But depending on what their general health, lung disease, smoking, heart disease, it can take a long time, particularly for older people. And then there's lots of, you know, we still have, I like to say to patients, we have islands of knowledge in a great sea of unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I didn't invent that thing, but I think it's wonderful. And there's a corollary: as the island of knowledge increases, the shore of ignorance also increases. We seem to get closer. You know, okay, we know that one kind of pneumonia is strep pneumonia, pneumococcal pneumonia. Okay, that's good. I, as a physician and nurses and everything, we breathe that in all the time. We take care of patients, and most of the time we don't get it. So it's around. So why does one person get it? We know sometimes, but and others don't. So there's ignorance. In fact, there's Encyclopedia of Ignorance I've seen, and the University of Arizona is running courses on medical ignorance, teaching students and residents what don't we know.
Margie, I want to say thank you for your call. But Dr. Kahn, we have about 1 minute left, and I want to ask you: do you believe that if in 1918 there were things like ventilators and there was more knowledge of virus, that we would have had the number of deaths that they had then? I think a lot of people look at the numbers from 1918 and they're worried that that's what's going to end up today, that we're going to look at something like 675,000 dead in the U.S. And millions in the world. Do you think that it is indeed quite different now or not really?
I think it is and it isn't. We have ventilators, oxygen that we didn't have then. But if you have a large number, and I said this a number of years ago, a large number of people, like the 1918 flu epidemic, once the ventilators are gone, there's going to be people and the ventilator isn't the cure for everybody. We're not very good at predicting. And George Hegel, in 200 years ago, a German philosopher said, the owl of Minerva spreads its wings only with the falling of the dusk. In other words, looking back, the goddess of wisdom, looking back at the end of the day, we will be able to say better. But I think we're not very good at predicting.
Right.
You know,
right.
What will be historic. And so I don't want to, I think.
Well, that's going to have to be our last word. I appreciate both of you spending time with us this hour. That's Richie Kahn, a retired internist with a longtime interest in medical history. His book, Diseases in the District of Maine, 1772 to 1820, the unpublished work of Jeremiah Barker, a rural physician in New England, will be published this August. Also with us for the hour, Jamie Rice, Director of Collections and Research with the Maine Historical Society. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Today's program will be rebroadcast at 7 this evening. Our theme music was written by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Stay with Maine Public for the latest update from the CDC. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.